This is tape recording number 50XXCXX of the Oakland Public Lecture Series. A tape recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard in 1950, the exact day and month is unknown. The title of this lecture is Language Adjustment. It is 55 minutes and 22 seconds long. Copyright C, 1950-1974 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by the Flag Audio Unit of the Flagship Apollo of the Sea Organization. And now, here is L. Ron Hubbard.
All right. Talking about language adjustment, of course, in this stage of the development of the human race, is a little bit difficult, since one is talking, of course, in a language which is about as aberrated as one could possibly invent. There's a general law which can be advanced on the subject of language adjustment. That is, the language is aberrating the direct proportion that it is has poor definition and homonymity. Now that maybe sounds like a mouthful, but that's not a mouthful. Poor definition. Let's say that we call this a wook, and we call this a wook, and we call this a wook. All right, now that would be homonymity. So that when we say wook, we could mean that, that, or that. This would become very confusing because somebody would run in and say, I left it right on the wook. And it would be here, or it would be over there, or it would be on a walk outside. And this would be very poor in the way of homonymity. On definition, it comes right into the same area, but it's a little bit different. Definition is very simple. We were talking about politics the other day. Now we have in the field of the political field of the world, probably the worst louse-up. I swear, not even a government bureau head could dream up as bad a louse-up as this situation with regard to ideology. We are dealing there with definition. A fellow by the name of Voltaire once said, if you would argue with me, define your terms. You can go further than that. If you would keep me sane, for Christ's sake, define your terms. You could say that. Because definition is terribly important. People go ramping around talking about communism. They go around talking about socialism, democracy, this, that. Every time we look this situation over and we try to find out what is one of these things, what's the gimmick? What's the process? What's the plan? And we look carefully and we find out that it could probably be stated in a book of 5,865,000 words, the first 8,000 or 9,000 words of which would have to do with explaining why there was no definition possible, and the remaining wordage explaining how that definition was modified. This would be a succinct statement of almost any ideology in the world today. Men are going out and getting shot over these things. That's incredible, but they are. Definition. They're awfully important. So, the definition of the words in the language are terribly important. We are moving in here a little bit into general thematics, but you will find that we are not wholly in the field of general semantics. There's quite a bit here which is over the side of the fence. In the first place, the whole field of perceptics is included. Not just words when we deal with the aberrating things. Because again, we're up against definition. Now, for instance, the definition of a color. Let's take a color definition of danger. What is it?
Red.
Why is it red?
Red.
Blood. Person ought to worry when he sees himself bleeding. Is that a very good definition?
No.
No, because after all, you shoot some game, and game is awfully good to eat, and game bleeds red. So that's pleasure. So it's not a broad definition at all. In these ideologies, somebody the other day wondered if I was a Republican. You can wonder as well if I am a Hindu or anything else. Within any field of ideology, for instance, there are a number of good things. This is inevitable. Even a totalitarian state, even a welfare state, even a corn and game state, even a Truman administration has something good in it. And
Namely, what's bad about these things is nobody has stated a definition of what's happening. So there's definition on a broad scale, and you can see the resultant aberration. Bad definition, practically alone and all by itself, is responsible for the possible precipitation of an international conflagration. That all by itself. Now, men dilate, rally around engineering many times out of a complete impatience for the lack of definition which used to exist in the fields of the humanities. They want definition. When somebody says work, they want foot pounds. Work. Let sense measure or experience this thing. And then we've got a definition. Or we say democracy, let's mean something else. But the engineer shudders away from all of this. Many engineers do. The lack of exactness. The military man who has spent the better part of his life in a military service comes out into civil life. He's appalled at the apparent looseness of organization and so forth, since he has lived along the lines of very precise definition of function. We come out and we find in civil life that a lawyer is very often doing an awful lot of accounting when he isn't buying something for somebody. And these functions all messed up, so we can never say the word lawyer and then be sure that we know exactly what this fellow's going to do, because there's the corporation lawyer and the criminal lawyer, and there's this lawyer and that lawyer, and we just can't say the word lawyer and instantly know. One of the ways to straighten this out, then, the way one would straighten out language, is to redefine it. Redefine all the terms in it. Now, it isn't good enough just to redefine all the terms. One would have to make each term possessed of a precise meaning. This probably means that one would probably swell up the English vocabulary to a couple of 100,000 words, and the fellow wouldn't be able to converse unless he had a vocabulary of 50 or 60,000 anyway. Well, if a human mind can't hold 50 or 60,000 precisely defined words, the guy ought to be shot anyway. Well, that's no great problem. It's a problem of education. The adjustment of language then would be the adjustment of terms. Of what are we talking? We would have to have, before we could do this, a knowledge and a precision knowledge of the humanities, because sloppy definition today exists because a sloppy knowledge of the humanities was in existence. One couldn't define things precisely because he had no precise definitions. We're in a little bit better position. We can define with some precision and accuracy most of the humanities now. This makes language adjustment possible from that quarter. It's not been possible before in the past. A lot of it was possible. Furthermore, they didn't know what were the aberrating phrases and what were the aberrating actions of language with any great precision, so they couldn't, of course, remove those aberrating things. The adjustment of language, of course, would mean the de-aberrating of it. And where we have definition of terms, we must also have definition of things, and so we must redefine all the things, and human beings happen to be one of the things which have to be redefined under language adjustment. The big aberrator in language, in English right now, is the failure to define the individual precisely. If one adjusted language just to this degree, he would have a successful action. That would be very successful. You'd probably pluck out 80-90% of the aberration out of language just by doing this one thing. Knocking out all pronouns. Bang. Out. So that every human being has a precision term, a definition which makes him an easily identifiable entity. The most flagrant violation of this is, of course, naming people Junior. That's a little off to the side of this, but it's an example of how criminal can you get. Junior. Why, it would seem to me that any race that knew anything at all would know better than to name somebody else. That is a surrender to the thirst for immortality by progeny, carried to an incredible extent, very harmful. People could have observed this without even knowing about embryos.
It's easy to observe. But it was just one of those data that rather floated around and nobody paid much attention to. It wasn't important anyway. What's another human being or what the hell?
There must have been a lot of lackadaisical atmosphere around this whole problem, otherwise somebody would have gotten up and done something about it. Now we take the pronouns. We take these beautiful pronouns like I, you, we, they, him, her. Where could you find a higher generality than in a word like I or you? There's a class of words which permit the widest possible misdefinition. They are homonyms. Very interesting. They make, it's a homonym, you see. I. Only each I is a different entity. Now we have the problem of using the word I, just using the word I all by itself, meaning referring to oneself. And he can keep on using this word I. Then it's possible to lay down a blanket aberration in the society that says, don't use this word I so much. It's bad. Which negates people. Here we have then a beautiful situation in an engram bank whereby the person can take all of the valences present and apply them to himself. Here you have a situation where comments of engrams ad infinitum can be applied to anyone with whom a person is associated. Here is this terrific, fantastic gunshot type of language organization, second only to the aberrated characteristics in the Japanese language. And that is really a language. It knocks the pronouns out. It defines so poorly. It has so many homonyms that when two Japanese meet and start discussing some subject, they very often have to take a pencil out of the pocket and make a notation on a little slip of paper and show it to the other one to get across the meaning. That's a fact. It has to do with the inflection in the speech. It has to do with the raise of the eyebrows or whether or not one's frowning at the moment, you see? It has to do with all of these things. And that's part of the communication. So what does an engram have? An engram doesn't define in tones. Somebody can say in a ridiculous tone of voice, oh, that feels so bad, meaning it feels wonderful. And in the engram it says that feels so bad. The engrams are tone deaf. As a result, the inflections never carry the meaning. And furthermore, there aren't recorded in any prenatal engrams the expressions on the faces of the people uttering the speech. Now, these words, then, and phrases fly in these engrams are very unselective. Now, if we have an existence in our language and in our culture, mechanisms which are super unselective, such as I, you, him, her, we're just asking for it. We can get a country so crazy that it will commit suicide. Japan tried. I'll call out to your attention. Japan didn't really have any idea she was going to be able to whip the United States. All of her attacks and everything else were sort of on a dab, we know we're going to fail basis. No follow-up on Pearl Harbor. It was theirs. No follow-up on this, no follow-up on that. We're just going to fight like hell. We know we're going to lose anyhow. Terrific verve in the process of committing harakiri. Characteristic of that war, as far as I was concerned, it was terribly, it was a gruesome war to that effect. You got this terrific valiant charges and attacks and plans and so forth. And the overall strategy of the whole thing sort of set failure. But they were willing to die to a man in failing. That was costly. But that's how a country can get crazy. And that country really is crazy. Japanese are very, very nice people. I have a lot of respect for them. I spoke Japanese with my kids, so I know what I'm talking about. And
when it comes down to aberrating language, I look at that language, I look at some of the other languages, and I find which ones have the most aberrating effect. And I find out that English is not leading the list by a long ways, but it's a long ways from the bottom of the list that's being the least aberrating. It was tough, because one would have to take pronouns in this fashion. This is a suggested lineup, which is very crude, but it will have to be done sooner or later, and it would be done more or less on this sort of thing. George, let's say one's name is George, and he says that he could say Georgie, which would mean I am George and I am speaking. And then he could say the other person's name when he said you. And you could end up or alter these names just a shade somewhere in the midst of them, which would make the application of whether or not it was subject or object, or whether or not it was possessive. The biggest job, the fastest job from the standpoint of a compiler and originator, would be to originate an entirely new language. The fastest job in terms of promulgation of that language would be to use English in this country. In other words, it would probably be much easier to reform and modify the language in current use than it would be to invent a new language, because there one is asking for a total jump to this. I'm just giving you a sketch of what the aberration would be. The target would be the redefinition of individuals by name in some such of a way as to make the language smooth to speak without stopping it too much, and make it very precisely defining of everything of which one spoke. That was the mission of general semantics. The children, by the way, start to lose their own identity little by little as engrams come in further and further. More and more engrams are stimulated. They run into more and more engrams, actually, as life accumulates them on them, until finally, by the time a person has gotten it into adulthood, he's lost about 90% of his own identity. Then he runs into a sheep psychology from the hands of a welfare state, and there goes the remaining part of it. And when he's lost all of his own identity, believe me, he's dead. The reason children are more acute and alive to life, so forth, it's a problem in balance. Very simple problem, a problem in balance. Now, when we have looked over the field of language adjustment, we find out that it would really not be a very tough job. Because you can throw in behind it the fact that a person is not quite nice who uses this aberrated language. You see, on the order of, you want to drive me nuts? You know, a person had that feeling towards somebody using it. He's not well educated, you know. Only it would be not, he's not well educated. You know. It would be Bill not educated, Joe knows. And it would cause people to be far more alert as to who was talking about what, too. You really have to track a conversation. And that beautiful, horrible, sweeping day that people use. You know, the mysterious day. That beautiful day is, the day that gets blamed for everything but never exists. All right. Now, the written part of language adjustment, as I mentioned the other day, is a much simpler affair. You could probably, one of these tapes is a lot better as far as the written language is concerned than anything we have in our printed books, because this stenotype tape is very condensed stuff. They've got all the symbols along, there's no doubts as to the definitions, there's nothing left understood, and yet the whole thing can be hung together very swiftly. Or there could be something like speed writing, where you just condense two or three letters and they represent a big polysyllabic word. So that those words are symbols anyway, and English as it exists today is the most incredibly spell language a foreigner ever met. So there is where we could just take the whole apple cart and dump it. Go on printing for a while, otherwise, and going down to speed writing, however, doesn't completely dump it, because it uses the word, uses the same letters and sounds. And the thing would just gradually contract it in, and a person would still be able to trace fairly well what he was reading. But people would have to be taught. If you started teaching little kids in school, you would have a new written language in another 10, 12 years.
Or you have a very broadly used form. It's a very good move. It's very economically sound in a society to do this thing. And furthermore, you have an aberrating factor involved in it. Not a very big one, but certainly enough. Written words are normally not as aberrating as spoken words because there's a perceptive bond out of it. When a person is listening to words, he sees a picture and he hears simultaneously, and when he's reading a word, he is just reading the word. He is seeing it. He's seeing the whole thing, so it isn't recorded over in the sonic fang. Now, that is about all I have to say, actually, about language adjustment beyond this, that a program has already been initiated. And when we get a little slack time and so on, why, we can pay a little more attention to that program. I don't think this thing is going to be very tough, and I already have had the word from several people of considerable consequence that this is strictly terrific. Only they didn't say it that way, being language experts. No amount of, well, preventive Dianetics, it's actually a section of preventive Dianetics. No amount of care around operations around pregnant mothers would assist to the degree that de-aberrating English would. I mean, you have to have both of them, of course, but words and engrams, words are still going to get into engrams, no matter how careful people are. Now, there's the matter of putting cancellors into babies. This has been brought up several times. You put a canceller into this baby as soon as you know he's there. You tell him he can remember everything that happened and so on. Might have some efficacy, but I kind of doubt it. I have found lots of phrases in engrams, and I've never found one that was a real assister. Once in a while, you'll find a phrase that says, let's go back over that again or something in some prenatal engram. Actually, in the engram, somebody just talking conversationally, not in Dianetics. And the person will get up to that phrase, and then you'll run the thing again. You'll run it again. You'll run it again. You finally run into this phrase. The scanner keeps hitting this phrase, and you go back over again, over again. That's an auditor assist, but not a very good one. All the rest of them are up to liability. So the installation of these cancellors and so forth in prenatal, I don't believe would be very good. There's only one thing we can do, is avoid forming engrams and de-aberrate the language that goes into them. And then, for the benefit of a sane social order, define everything in it well enough so that nothing is left hanging by the boards. I can guarantee you absolutely this, that where you have a difference of opinion, an argument, particularly a violent one, if that argument were dissected, you would find out that it was being waged on a subject where one person understood that the subject was one thing and the other person understood the subject was the other, but neither one of them had precisely defined his terms. And so, Voltaire there a couple hundred years ago was right on the ball. In other words, Mama says, you're different from I am, you could never be like me, and Mama's a good cook, you'll find this person not doing well with cookery. They could wipe out all the household arts out of a woman with that engram. The wickedest and most sorrowful engram I think I ever ran into was an AA on Christmas Eve. Well, this was a fool. This person would even start to come near a Christmas tree and just go to pieces. He didn't want anything to do with Christmas or any part of Christmas. And presents, he was very peculiar about presents. Anybody would try to give him a present, he would say the social amenities of thank you very much, oh yes, I enjoy it a great deal, and then hastily and hurriedly throw it into a trunk, get it out of sight, lock it down so that he wouldn't run into it again. And this peculiar behavior is occasioned by this very, very sad engram, because it was a mutual AA, and Papa was being very, very brutal. He got drunk. He decided that he didn't want any children around and so forth. He did this AA against protest, and he's talking about Christmas and so on, and then he says, I've got a present for him. Needle thrust, right straight through, and I've got a present for him. I really think that guy's life up, What's left one phrase?
Mama went to the doctor shortly afterwards and got herself packed and passed up and so forth, and the baby came through normal. Now, a valence call-in. You can get a call-in on valences. It says something on the order of, why don't you be like me? Or why don't you be like your Uncle Oscar? Why don't you be like other children? Puts this guy into about 40 assorted children's valences. He's being commanded into the valence, actually, but they call him in. Be more like me, dear. So on. Of course, being commanded in on the other side, you're just like other children, is it? Now, I can't be myself, of course, is a bouncer out of one's own valence. So, in other words, you can work them out yourself, the series, and it'd be better if you did, figure them out. You can have valences, get call-ins and bouncers out of, and holders. You're always like your father. That is a holder in a valence. That's her name. Deniers, no such person exists. I ran into this weird combination one time, whereby a guy had appeared with a certain name early in the prenatal period, and Papa and Mama were arguing about this person very violently, terrific argument in progress, and she was accusing him of being unfaithful, and he was trying to throw a friend into the breach, and she said, this fellow's name, we'll just make it Bill, no such person exists as Bill. Of course, this is all forgotten. He sort of made it up. It was a favorite name of Papa's. So that when the child was born, he named the child William. Of course, this fight hadn't been much of an engram or an upset on the thing, but there was no such person as Bill. That kicked him out of his own valence all the time. Who the hell was he? The person used to sit around and say to himself, who am I? Who am I? As a matter of fact, a person can always sit down and say, who am I, and repeat his name over several times and get the damnedest separation from reality he ever wants to feel. But when he's got an engram along in this line and he repeats his name several times, and that name's included in engram, he's going to re-stimulate the engram. It's liable to have a lot of other things. So the adventure of repeating one's name many, many times gets some very odd experiences. That's why girls, for instance, start using their second name instead of their first name, and I think why a lot of them want to be married. Okay. These valence commands, back and forth, quite important, and usually you ask the person for a valence shifter, and he will give you something like a valence shifter. You can explain to a preclear what a valence shifter is, and so on. Or you just recognize one as it goes by. Oh, he wanted to know what percentage a person, if you could ask the file clerk about a percentage. No, I wouldn't do that. Isn't it that important? The person is either getting the somatic or he's not getting the somatic. And actually getting down in the basic part of the tract, he will get it if he's on valence. These cases are always complicated by valence shifters. You get homosexuality is a valence shifter proposition of enormous magnitude. The way we solve such a case is to find the dramatization on the part of either parent, which would, in your opinion, thoroughly shift there to the opposite sex. You just keep straight lining this case and working it way up the track, so you'll eventually find one of those things. And you'll get that dramatization, and it'll be a super powerful. That's what causes it. There is the exact pinpoint cause of it right there. That's how important valence shifts are, incidentally. You'll find that most of these that are fairly shifted, the valence shifters sort of compound so that you'll have 15 varieties all adding up to the same thing. There are too many vectors here pointing to the same conclusion. And a person can have valence shifters to the right and valence shifters to the left and so on all over the shop. But they're doing a bit of balance on the thing, and they just throw him into an idling valence. But you have one which concentrates 100% on
You are father. You are father. You are father. And it adds up in dozens of different ways. You are a boy. I am sorry you are a girl. You are a boy. And so on. And we eventually wind up with one of these dull shifts over into a bay. You will find out that many psychoses, transvestites, for instance, a transvestite who insists on wearing the clothes of the opposite sex, has gotten a very large valence shifter thrown into the case. And it hasn't been just repeated once. It's been repeated over and over in many forms and ways, which eventually lead them to the inevitable conclusion that the thing to do is to wear the clothes of the opposite sex. And it says wear the clothes of the opposite sex, in essence. I found one case where the husband, the one would never, on God's green earth, think of this person ever being along in that line because he was a very strong, virile man. During coitus, he used to put on makeup and a woman's lace nightgown. And his child was a transvestite. That's of a nice division. One can get interesting answers or useful answers. And you can ask the press for all the interesting answers you want, but, that would serve no benefit, and you don't use them. For heaven's sake, though, don't use the file clerk to give you opinions. He is a world's worst judge. The function of the eye is the function of a judge. The function of the file clerk is the last order of court recorder.
Gets it. It's a very simple mechanism. is very easily framed in this analogy. The attention units which are nearest to the standard bank are the least aberrated. Now, this follows, then, that they would get better information quicker than I. After a while, the whole mind can, as one of its very minute functions, give forth data like the file clerk does. A clerk functions when he wants a specific piece of information almost on a flash answer basis, because all of the attention units there can drag this material up when wanted. But that's a minor function. The file clerk is not very terribly important. He's back there, back at the data. All the data is available. All you can get his hands on, that is. Sometimes you can't get his hands on while he's in there. But these are the attention units back of the mind up against the standard bank. And therefore, they see all, they know all, and they think nothing. Now, I and the analyzer, the computing machinery, and all the other stuff which in its high order of complexity make up the analytical mind are affected by engrams. And the file clerk can fetch up one of these engrams and set it up there. He isn't affected by this engram, but this engram, the second it's there, now throws its impact against I. I cuts down, the analyzer starts to get a little bit anatomic, other things happen, but you've still got a file clerk alert and functioning back of all of this mechanism. That's the file clerk. The computing machinery isn't available to him. It's all tied up with circuits and everything else. So that's the guy, and that's all that you want. Yes, no, number, word, name, holder, bouncer, denier. He gets educated up to what holders, bouncers, and deniers are. But he is the same order of being as I. It's as though a little fragment of I is clear back here in the back of the mind, left free from the aberration. Now, first, in front of the far front of the circuit, there are the circuits up in front of the file clerk. They're on and interposed between the file clerk and I. As long as those circuits exist, file clerk answers can wander around, you can get demon answers, you can get all sorts of things on the thing. But some part of the mind will always answer any question you give it. Some part of it will get some reaction, even if the reaction is just no answer. There is no answer to this, it's right, but no answer, so there's some part of the mind responding. Now, the circuitry, portion of the mind, of course, if it is up front there and you've got demon setups in such a way, you ask for a flash and in comes the data. But what kind of data? Now, therefore, you want to give your file clerk very rapid questions. Rapid, brief questions with monosyllabic answers. I am not even content that the file clerk knows whether or not a person's in his own balance, whether or not he has the power of observing this, because it requires a much broader vista of observation. The auditor, however, can tell whether or not a person's in his own balance with the greatest of ease. He just looks. He can tell whether or not he's in an engram with the greatest of ease. He tells which. He can tell whether or not he's in a grief discharge area. He heaves and sighs and he checks. These are fairly uniform manifestations. That's another thing I've seen as an error, is people don't allow people enough time to move on the track. It only requires seconds. But remember, the seconds still have to intervene. Maybe it only requires 5 or 6 seconds. But 5 or 6 seconds run like this. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's quite a long time, isn't it? And it requires time to go up and down this track. If a person isn't taking time to go up and down the track, he is not moving on the track. Then a person throws his eyes open instantly. When you've just finished reducing an engram, you say, come up to present time, you go. He is still stuck at that point. So you better do something. Say, just close your eyes. Now let's go to the last phrase again. Give me yes or no. Hold it. I'm not running down the usefulness of the file clerk here, by the way. not in any way. That fire search is dreadfully useful. But the way he's being used as a mechanism by some people is sort of like a kid using a watch to drive nails. In other words, in his sphere of activity, he is enormously useful. The tool is a very good tool. But just as a carpenter must understand what to do with a plane, so must you understand what to do with a fire plug and a somatic strip. These tools are precision tools. They don't vary from day to day or patient to patient. The bulk of the trouble that any class has in studying Dianetics comes from their initial lack of satisfaction, according to their own eyes, with the precision character of the tools which they are using. You use these tools by rote for a short time, and you will see how confoundedly precise they are. And after you have discovered this and established it to your own complete satisfaction, then you can go over the hills and far away, and I'm safe in saying that because you won't.
Now, let me make a few delicate
I meant to say some little thing. I don't want to speak very harshly about this, but I tell you this. I want to ask you this one little question. Why the hell don't you get grief out? I watch some of the standard procedure work. Some of the standard procedure work is standard from step four on. That is to say, get in the basic area and give an engram. Got to get in the basic area and give an engram. Quick. Wham, wham, run, run. Where basic area can't get in. Don't understand why this case isn't making any progress, but we sure are running these out-of-valence engrams. We sure are having a fine time here. Yes, sir. The fellow can find phrases and repeat them for hours. That's gorgeous. Grief is a terrific suppressor. You get too much grief on a case that's ready to come off. The grief's going to come off the case, or early engrams are going to come off, one or the other. But if there's grief on the case, the early engrams aren't going to come off. So there's nothing like cutting your own throats. It's tacit consent that does it. I can tell you that right now. A fellow has a grief charge on him. He starts somebody back down the track, and he'd rather be shot than re-experience this grief. So he says, the fellow says, well, that was my grandmother. Go basic. When a guy can run the death in his own veins, you can get the grief off. By the way, sometimes grief doesn't come off merely because the auditor doesn't get the guy into his own valence. You know that if you run through a grief sequence once, the ordinary course of human affairs is to have the freight player outside himself at that moment of grief. It is a great mechanical displacer of the individual. It automatically shifts valence. The grief itself shifts valence without a command. So they run over it once, the guy may still be out of balance. Twice, the pre-clear may still be out of balance. Three times, he may still be out of balance. Four times, still. Five, all of a sudden, in balance and boo-hoo-hoo. There are out of balance shifters which do that, but in addition to that, there is a mechanical transplanter. You see, the mechanism of balance shift exists to keep the mind, if thought, intact. So the guy just moved out. It became too much to bear. For instance, a terrific somatic all by itself can kick a person out of balance. No valence shifter present. Terrific somatic, he maybe run the first part of the somatic, then kick, and out of valence he goes. And you have to run it several times and run the other valences. Running in the other valences, shift them, one to the other valences. Be Papa, you aren't using this mechanism enough, and boy, that's a valuable one. You're worrying too much about getting the person into his own balance before you let him talk. You let him scream as Papa, or yell as Mama, or do anything as Mama wants to do, so forth, weep, or anything like that, weep somebody else's tears, as they do prenatally, and eventually until you knock tension off the two sides of the thing until you can get him into his own valence and run it. There is our top somatic, our top green charge. We're doing automatic mechanical skid out. Why do you think this valence exists as a mechanism? It existed first as a mechanism before language existed. You'll find dogs out of their own valence. Sure, there's many a dog in his master's valence. Look at him. The dog looks exactly like him, but let's not neglect the dog. I just want to show you, though, these mechanisms didn't suddenly get invented by the guy who invented English. They existed as native mechanisms of the mind. And in English, birds, language, French, German, or Dutch, it didn't matter, walked in on these mechanisms and started to really fix them up. How do you avoid pain? That's the primary mission there. Let's get away from pain. Well, that's another trick, getting away from pain. And there may be, by the way, another trick that we haven't discovered yet. A person will try to get out of a painful engram regardless of what happens. That's an ordinary mechanism. He sort of bounces off the pain itself. It doesn't have to be a bouncer. Sometimes this happens. He'll bounce out of valence because of the pain. He'll do the same thing by grief. He will bounce off the grief charge all by itself. And he will skid out of valence on the grief charge all by itself. So you start running this stuff while he's out of valence, and you can run it, run it, run it, and all of a sudden he'll smack into his own valence. When you get him in his own valence, he'll have tears. Unless, of course, he's in the valence of somebody else who is crying. So you run him through that until he cries out this other person's tears, and then you still find out if he's in his own valence. You'll know that he can see himself. He's not in his own valence. This seems to me to be rather obvious. You'll find people who are standing there, and every time mama and baby are present, why, there he is standing in some other quarter of the room, and you say, where's papa? I don't know. But there's me. There's mama. I don't know where papa is. That's even papa's valence. Now, he can get around to where he's sitting up on top of the clock, too. He's out of all valences. Planes that'll do this sort of thing, if this had been you, it would have been killed, or you would have been killed, or something like that. You would have been killed if you were had been there, or that boy had been you, you would have been killed, or something of the sort. Places of that character had a tendency to slide them out. This one will kill you. Boy, you should listen these days to the conversation amongst musicians. There are going to be some children of musicians who are going to be occupying sanitariums. You know how it is with me these days. Everywhere is nowhere.
Yeah. You're out of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everything's cool and crazy.
Yeah.
Believe me.
It's just gruesome. That was all sorts of. Now, I'm just calling this to your attention on the matter of grief charge, and I hope to call to your attention this one last time, and I don't want to be unnecessarily rude about it, but God damn it, you're off grief! It's terribly important. Don't bypass that plain standard procedure. I just figured out the reason why the stories in the Saturday Evening Post are as bad as they are. That is to say, in popular magazines and in lesser mediums, why they're as bad as they are. This society has the phrase writing things down. And if you notice, in all the fields of the arts, they keep talking about writing things down to people's IQ. And it never seems to occur to anybody to write them up. I guess a person who has a write-it-up engram would be writing for Atlantic Monthly. A person who has a write-it-down engram. I would dearly love to see everybody in the class clear, but if you're going to get clear, it's going to be on your own. That's, I'm afraid, the consequences of the thing. It's sort of an automatic natural selection, by the way. The number of clears are going to be established by the number of people who have enough push to go on toward the target, because they're going to get about halfway between normal and clear, and they'll feel so good, they'll kind of slow down and stop. Or get latched up in a manic someplace and start to feel very wonderful now. A case is open as far as I'm concerned.
One, grief discharge, the major grief discharges are offered to, and a basic area engram has been run and reduced. A case is way open when you've got conception of it.
And they haven't had sonic in that area?
No, but the fellow didn't get sonic in that area, said he was out of wheelies. Now, a person getting a case reasonably open has nothing to do with getting him in his own valence all the way up and down the track. You can sweat over this for a long, long time. But you have getting a case open can be succinctly stated just in these phrases, that you know now the case can be run by reasonably standard auditing, nothing very brilliant. The case can go on and be run and finally wind up as a very good release and as a clear. You've established this. The person is not permanently latched up on the track. He's not lost up in some direction or another. You've established, really, this case will run nicely now with minimal trouble. That's, I call a case open anytime I can put my hands on the case and get action. That case is open, that case is running. I have seen somebody run for 150 hours out of his own valence. I've seen another guy run 480 hours out of his own valence. And he was still reducing somatics. By the way, he was getting to a point where the anaten was so heavy on the case and so poorly shed that if he went back 24 hours, he'd get yawns on somebody saying hello. But he was eventually slopped over into his own valence and anaten or boil off is done. The case came out all right. But a case is just open there when you're assured that this case is well to go. It takes a lot of auditing. A release is way up there in terms of time. You can count in working in Dianetics for probably many months of knocking off 6, 8, 10 hours a week of auditing. Now, the chronic somatic, somebody has try to make the definition that a case is open when the chronic somatics are gone. That would be a very silly definition, because all the chronic somatics are gone. You can only be sure they're gone when an erasure of the bank has taken place. Then you're sure of that. But you can be sure that if a case has out a basic area engram, that it did reduce, you got off yawns, that's very important, that case will run. Furthermore, you know this case is moving freely on the track and that a reasonable amount of sentient, rational auditing will take care of this case and keep it going. Now, there is where you know a case is definitely open. There is usually an attendant resurgence on the opening of a case. These are definitions. These definitions are probably not too well understood. But if the case could be run with a standard line of auditing, no big, clever, heavy battery stuff needed on it, that case is definitely open. That case will attain a release. These things I have said pretty much before. I've said them right here. I confirm them again by saying them today. None of this is new data I'm giving you. Believe me. The only thing that concerns me with the cases that are present, I want to make sure those cases are open. Like to see them open, so that we don't have a heavy battery stuff. I guess sometimes we get a case, a kind of loud stuff that people will feel that we don't have too much. The person is excited, he's worried about his case. Nobody's hit the right computation on the case. Their computation's a bit off, and as a result, BP is shutting stuff around, and he's shutting stuff around. Don't like it. So they protest. Somebody may have even gotten engrams off of this person, basic area and so on, and then some new computations come up. But you can expect a cyclic, that is to say, an undulant increase in general tone. But that is an undulant increase in general tone. It is a curve which starts here, let's say, normal here. Then you run the thing for a little while, and the guy gets badly restimulated, maybe his tone will drop. This is usual, of course. It'll go along badly, down, and then up, and down, and then all of a sudden, if you're getting up above this level a little bit. So now we're getting up, and we make some good surges, and then bosh, here. 2 days, case stays very badly bogged. And then all of a sudden, up here. And it's an undulant curve in the interest of, and goes on up like that, but it is not a straight line. They're definitely not a straight line. The somatics kick in, somatics kick out. Sometimes somebody's working one part of the chain and knocks another one into a stimulation and so forth. But it is a consistent increase. You take the overall period of week by week and measure it week by week, and you will find out that the tone of any one week is better than the tone of any past week. Your preacher continually discourages you about this because he says always he's got to get that next engram that you've already knocked out of in this report. That with a racehorse, he's sort of impatient now. He's got to get going. It's the new engram that's important. Sometimes you have to slow the guy down. You have to say, hey, how did you feel on August the 10th? Well, how'd that feel when? August the 10th? Having a hard time, see, because the other data has been clipped, and August the 10th, the sorrows of August the 10th were locks on him. So he asked him not what happened, he could tell you that theory enough, but how did he feel, which is a different thing. So he said, yes, I was depressed, and I remember beating my wife up in the morning and then suicide in the afternoon. He treated sinusitis and operated on appendicitis that night. I don't feel well these days at all. Now, we just got to get the rest of these engrams. The guy's been in fine shape for a long time. You finally break it down and he says, yes, I felt horrible. No, life was not worth living. Now I feel wonderful. Now I feel fine. Are you satisfied? How about let's bring after that newest AA you just bought? That's the kind of stuff you get. It's very discouraging, Doctor. It's second only to the type of discouragement you get when you turned off somebody's migraine headache on straight wire or something of the sort. And then he says, you know, I knew that bromo cells would help me. I give you a word of caution, don't hit him with a baseball bat or anything at that point. But I give you a word of warning about it. Even though the person's returned on the track, over 50% of his analytical mind is working, and it's not working out of engrams, it's working out of English. But the engrams are full of English, and he has to use English to express himself. And it is only at the time when he is returned directly to and is sitting right on an engram that he will use its phrases. Now, for heaven's sake, don't go around baiting each other with this. You know that sort of thing can set up a dwindling spiral on a guy? It can depress his morale and everything else. Because what's being postulated at him is he talks and thinks out of nothing but engrams. It's not true. Very strict to be told. The reason husband-wife teams fail is because they get into the type of argument of this sort of thing. He runs off an engram, and then she maybe is anxious to prove to him that he has dramatized it many times, and that was the source of all of that fight. One of the answers that can be given to them is look at them speculatively and wonder what manner of engramming computation they have, you see, that causes them to have to seek importance on this level. But that sounds a little bit bitter, so the best thing to do is just give them a surprised look, you know, and say, bad dianetic manners. There is another thing that sets in, dianetically speaking, a matter of self-determinism. When a group is operating as a group, particularly when it has been introduced to confusion, it has a tendency to act as a group rather than individuals to some degree, which is very bad. It shouldn't work this way. People ought to act as individuals. Self-determinism. This sort of trick that he mentions is being pulled by PAs, a very shabby trick. It is aimed toward cutting down a person's self-determinism and cutting down his power as one of the most powerful mechanisms which you could possibly line up against the person in order to render him unimportant. Well, that sort of thing and that sort of atmosphere would also be conducive to this, that self-determinism would suffer, you see, to the degree of being cared for to some degree. Now, we have been engaged here in training. Most of the talk which I have heard has been, unfortunately, on the subject of treating. That is to say, I have heard many more worries about individual cases than I have heard about worrying about other people's cases. I would say it's a very bad symptom. The point being that the cases not important enough compared to the training to stack up and hold up training. Actually, that's true. It is also true that one can't really make a good auditor until he's gotten up to a point where he's had some tension taken off his own case. He can advance his own case far enough, he gets into pretty good shape, and his auditing curve really comes up.
I have seen that. That is a fantastic thing.
Auditing really comes up. When you get a good, solid release on the guy and he's going on ahead to clear, boy, that quality of the auditing starts into a stellar role compared to the rest of them. Dianetics in an organization, it is our great point that we've got what cures inefficiency. If we can only keep on employing it, we don't get so inefficient that it can't be employed. Instead of looking to anyone or anything on the subject of your own case, how about to taking an opposite viewpoint and starting to worry about other people's cases? To the point of getting in there with your two bare hands and tearing the damn case apart and resolving it. Now that would be a very sentient maneuver. Furthermore, you should make plans, particularly if you're leaving this area, you should make some sort of a plan or arrangement in order to increase and speed up your case. Now, how do you? It's been set up and often remarked back east that this is the optimum, but it doesn't seem to be very practical. I mean, it isn't workable. Somebody comes in from Fresno, let's say, and only one person comes in from Fresno. And we get this one person from Fresno, and the case is open all right, but this person goes back to Fresno and is now confronted with a lot of auditing, which this person now looks at with horror. Isn't going to be audited. Well, it has a solution. What you do is just sit down and you just train somebody, you see. You do it well. And when you train 5, 6, 8, you let them work on the old master. And you finally get one, you can really move the case down. You have to beware of this bear trap, that you'll pick a weak one who won't push. That is a danger. Pick the toughie. Don't pick up the weak one. See how that would be. There's a lot of that. That is a little patty cake mechanism that is just beautiful, and a case will stay awfully static. I have seen a case hang fire for 8 consecutive months of being audited a minimum of 4 hours a week. Remain static. Which, when walked into by a person of comparable force to the person who's being audited, started resolving like wildfire. Now there's that danger. You want to be clear, steer wide of that one. Steer wide of passive consent, and steer wide of that tendency to pick a weak auditor. That is the way, that method of having to train up somebody, that is the way that I got as far as I got.
That's the way most of the people initially associated with Dianetics have to do. And until such time as there are just lots of them all over the place, they will have to go on feeling that. It's a state of existence with only a sweep of a magic wand can change, and we're working like hell with that magic wand right now, but it takes some time. So the best thing we can do is to make sure we're get out of these cases open, at least. Now, you undoubtedly elected amongst you who are good auditors, who are good student auditors, who aren't. It's a wonder to me that there aren't more people in this class who haven't already picked up a clientele. I've seen it happen. Sure. Would you audit me today? Would you do this, would you do that, and so forth, because that sort of thing goes on. But the way to solve this thing is actually to get going. You have the information. You may appear that your information is insufficient. What you want to do is to put it into practice. You find out it'll get facile enough, quick enough, and you address it to a few bricklayers. You'll have to train up somebody. Make them read the book and so forth. That's why I'm trying to put out more training literature.
these lectures and so on here are all being put together. They won't be available immediately because it takes a little while to transcribe these things and to publish them. But such things will be available. You'll be able then to throw such things, the bulletin which contains standard procedures, the book with people. You work them for a while, you open up their case, they get the feel of it, you supervise them for a while, because you only need dealing with a very few people to be able to do it fairly rapidly. You get on your own case and you have to face that. What the 10-day process is set up to do, it is designed as something which can be carried forward in a clearing center. Basically, go to a clearing center and with auditing consistently, having, let's say, having a couple of auditors, both of them good auditors, being run by these two auditors, one running in morning, the other running in afternoon, something like that, go through 3 days of intensive, and then 7 days, maybe a media running. That was standard procedure, and wind up at the end of that time in a fair situation. That is designed to happen at a clearing center under good auditing.
You have just heard a tape-recorded lecture given by L. Ron Hubbard, founder of Dianetics and Scientology.